Listening Library presents His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. Book 2, The Subtle Knife. Chapter 1, The Cat and the Hornbeam Trees. Will tugged at his mother's hand and said,
"Come on, come on!"
But his mother hung back. She was still afraid. Will looked up and down the narrow street in the evening light, along the little terrace of houses, each behind its tiny garden and its box hedge, with the sun glaring off the windows of one side and leaving the other in shadow. There wasn't much time. People would be having their meal about now, and soon there would be other children around to stare and comment and notice. It was dangerous to wait, but all he could do was persuade her as usual.
"Mum, let's go in and see Mrs. Cooper. Look, we're nearly there."
"Mrs. Cooper?"
But he was already ringing the bell. He had to put down the bag to do it because his other hand still held his mother's. It might have bothered him at 12 years of age to be seen holding his mother's hand, but he knew what would happen to her if he didn't. The door opened, and there was the stooped elderly figure of the piano teacher, with a scent of lavender water about her as he remembered.
"Who's that? Is that William? I haven't seen you for over a year. What do you want, dear?"
"I want to come in, please, and bring my mother."
Mrs. Cooper looked at the woman with the untidy hair and the distracted half-smile, and at the boy with the fierce, unhappy glare in his eyes, the tight-set lips, the jutting jaw. And then she saw that Mrs. Parry, Will's mother, had put makeup on one eye but not on the other. And she hadn't noticed. And neither had Will. Something was wrong.
"Well,"
she said, and stepped aside to make room in the narrow hall. Will looked up and down the road before closing the door, and Mrs. Cooper saw how tightly Mrs. Parry was clinging to her son's hand, and how tenderly he guided her into the sitting room where the piano was. Of course, that was the only room he knew. And she noticed that Mrs. Parry's clothes smelled slightly musty, as if they'd been too long in the washing machine before drying, and how similar the two of them looked as they sat on the sofa with the evening sun full on their faces, their broad cheekbones, their wide eyes, their straight black brows.
"What is it, William? What's the matter?"
"My mother needs somewhere to stay for a few days. It's too difficult to look after her at home just now. I don't mean she's ill. She's just kind of confused and muddled, and she gets a bit worried. She won't be hard to look after. She just needs someone to be kind to her. And I think you could do that quite easily, probably."
The woman was looking at her son without seeming to understand, and Mrs. Cooper saw a bruise on her cheek. Will hadn't taken his eyes off Mrs. Cooper, and his expression was desperate.
"She won't be expensive. I've brought some packets of food, enough to last, I should think. You could have some of it too. She won't mind sharing."
"But I don't know if I should. Doesn't she need a doctor?"
"No, she's not ill."
"But there must be someone who can... I mean, isn't there a neighbour or someone in the family?"
"We haven't got any family. Only us. And the neighbours are too busy."
"What about the social services? I don't mean to put you off, dear, but..."
"No! No. She just needs a bit of help. I can't do it myself for a little while, but I won't be long. I've got things to do, but I'll be back soon and I'll take her home again, I promise. You won't have to do it for long."
The mother was looking at her son with such trust, and he turned and smiled at her with such love and reassurance that Mrs. Cooper couldn't say no.
"Well,"
she said, turning to Mrs. Parry,
"I'm sure it won't matter for a day or so. You can have my daughter's room, dear. She's in Australia. She won't be needing it again."
"Thank you,"
said Will, and stood up as if he were in a hurry to leave.
"But where are you going to be?"
"I'm going to be staying with a friend. I'll phone up as often as I can. I've got your number. It'll be all right."
His mother was looking at him, bewildered. He bent over and kissed her clumsily.
"Don't worry. Mrs. Cooper will look after you better than me, honest. And I'll phone up and talk to you tomorrow."
They hugged tightly, and then Will kissed her again and gently unfastened her arms from his neck before going to the front door. Mrs. Cooper could see he was upset, because his eyes were glistening, but he turned, remembering his manners, and held out his hand.
"Goodbye, and thank you very much."
"William, I wish you'd tell me what the matter is."
"It's a bit complicated, but she won't be any trouble, honestly."
That wasn't what she meant, and both of them knew it. But somehow Will was in charge of this business, whatever it was. The old lady thought she'd never seen a child so implacable. He turned away, already thinking about the empty house. The close where Will and his mother lived was a loop of road in a modern estate with a dozen identical houses, of which theirs was by far the shabbiest. The front garden was just a patch of weedy grass. His mother had planted some shrubs earlier in the year, but they'd shriveled and died for lack of watering. As Will came round the corner, his cat, Moxie, rose up from her favourite spot under the still-living hydrangea and stretched before greeting him with a soft meow and butting her head against his leg. He picked her up and whispered,
"Have they come back, Moxie? Have you seen them?"
The house was silent. In the last of the evening light, the man across the road was washing his car, but he took no notice of Will, and Will didn't look at him. The less notice people took, the better. Holding Moxie against his chest, he unlocked the door and went in quickly. Then he listened very carefully before putting her down. There was nothing to hear. The house was empty. He opened a tin for Moxie and left her to eat in the kitchen. How long before the men came back? There was no way of telling, so he'd better move quickly. He went upstairs and began to search. He was looking for a battered green leather writing case. There are a surprising number of places to hide something that size, even in any ordinary modern house. You don't need secret panels and extensive cellars in order to make something hard to find. Will searched his mother's bedroom first, ashamed to be looking through the drawers where she kept her underclothes, and then he worked systematically through the rest of the rooms upstairs, even his own. Moxie came to see what he was doing and sat and cleaned herself nearby, for company. But he didn't find it. By that time it was dark and he was hungry. He made himself baked beans on toast and sat at the kitchen table wondering about the best order to look through the downstairs rooms. As he was finishing his meal, the phone rang. He sat absolutely still, his heart thumping. He counted. 26 rings and then it stopped. He put his plate in the sink and started to search again. 4 hours later, he still hadn't found the green leather case. It was 1:30 and he was exhausted. He lay on his bed fully clothed and fell asleep at once, his dreams tense and crowded, his mother's unhappy, frightened face always there, just out of reach. And almost at once, it seemed, though he'd been asleep for nearly 3 hours, he woke up knowing two things simultaneously. First, he knew where the case was, and second, he knew that the men were downstairs, opening the kitchen door. He lifted Moxie out of the way and softly hushed her sleepy protest. Then he swung his legs over the side of the bed and put on his shoes, straining every nerve to hear the sounds from downstairs. They were very quiet sounds, a chair being lifted and replaced, a short whisper, the creak of a floorboard. Moving more silently than the men were, he left his bedroom and tiptoed to the spare room at the top of the stairs. It wasn't quite pitch dark, and in the ghostly grey pre-dawn light he could see the old treadle sewing machine. He'd been through the room thoroughly only hours before, but he'd forgotten the compartment at the side of the sewing machine, where all the patterns and bobbins were kept. He felt for it delicately, listening all the while. The men were moving about downstairs, and Will could see a dim flicker of light that might have been a flashlight at the edge of the door. Then he found the catch of the compartment and clicked it open, and there, just as he'd known it would be, was the leather writing case. And now what could he do? He crouched in the dimness, heart pounding, listening hard. The two men were in the hall downstairs. He heard one of them say quietly,
"Come on. I can hear the milkman down the road."
"It's not here, though. We'll have to look upstairs."
"Go on, then. Don't hang about."
Will braced himself as he heard the quiet creak of the top step. The man was making no noise at all, but he couldn't help the creak if he wasn't expecting it. Then there was a pause. A very thin beam of flashlight swept along the floor outside. Will saw it through the crack. Then the door began to move. Will waited till the man was framed in the open doorway and then exploded up out of the dark and crashed into the intruder's belly, but neither of them saw the cat. As the man had reached the top step, Moxie had come silently out of the bedroom and stood with raised tail just behind the man's legs, ready to rub herself against them. The man, who was trained and fit and hard, could have dealt with Will, but the cat was in the way, and as the man tried to move back, he tripped over her. With a sharp gasp, he fell backwards down the stairs and crashed his head brutally against the hall table. Will heard a hideous crack and didn't stop to wonder about it. Clutching the writing case, he swung himself down the banister, leaping over the man's body that lay twitching and crumpled at the foot of the flight, seized the tattered tote bag from the table, and was out of the front door and away before the other man could do more than come out of the living room and stare. Even in his fear and haste, Will wondered why the other man didn't shout after him or chase him. They'd be after him soon, though, with their cars and their cell phones. The only thing to do was run. He saw the milkman turning into the close, the lights of his electric cart pallid in the dawn glimmer that was already filling the sky. Will jumped over the fence into the next-door garden, down the passage beside the house, over the next garden wall, across a dew-wet lawn, through the hedge and into the tangle of shrubs and trees between the housing estate and the main road. There he crawled under a bush and lay panting and trembling. It was too early to be out on the road. Wait till later when the rush hour started. He couldn't get out of his mind the crack as the man's head struck the table, and the way his neck was bent so far and in such a wrong way, and the dreadful twitching of his limbs. The man was dead. He'd killed him. He couldn't get it out of his mind, but he had to. There was quite enough to think about. His mother, would she really be safe where she was? Mrs. Cooper wouldn't tell, would she? Even if Will didn't turn up as he'd said he would? Because he couldn't, now that he'd killed someone. And Moxie? Who'd feed Moxie? Would Moxie worry about where they were? Would she try to follow them? It was getting lighter by the minute. It was light enough already to check through the things in the tote bag. His mother's purse, the latest letter from the lawyer, the road map of southern England, chocolate bars, toothpaste, spare socks and pants, and the green leather writing case. Everything was there. Everything was going according to plan, really. Except that he'd killed someone. Will had first realized his mother was different from other people, and that he had to look after her, when he was 7. They were in a supermarket and they were playing a game. They were allowed to put an item in the cart only when no one was looking. It was Will's job to look all around and whisper, "Now!" And she would snatch a tin or a packet from the shelf and put it silently into the cart. When things were in there, they were safe, because they became invisible. It was a good game, and it went on for a long time, because this was a Saturday morning and the shop was full, but they were good at it and worked well together. They trusted each other. Will loved his mother very much and often told her so, and she told him the same. So when they reached the checkout, Will was excited and happy because they'd nearly won. And when his mother couldn't find her purse, that was part of the game too, even when she said the enemies must have stolen it. But Will was getting tired by this time, and hungry too, and Mummy wasn't so happy anymore. She was really frightened, and they went around and around putting things back on the shelves, but this time they had to be extra careful because the enemies were tracking them down by means of her credit card numbers, which they knew because they had her purse. And Will got more and more frightened himself. He realized how clever his mother had been to make this real danger into a game so that he wouldn't be alarmed, and how, now that he knew the truth, he had to pretend not to be frightened so as to reassure her. So the little boy pretended it was a game still, so she didn't have to worry that he was frightened, and they went home without any shopping but safe from the enemies. And then Will found the purse on the hall table anyway. On Monday they went to the bank and closed her account, and opened another somewhere else, just to be sure. Thus the danger passed. But sometime during the next few months, Will realized slowly and unwillingly that those enemies of his mother's were not in the world out there, but in her mind. That made them no less real, no less frightening and dangerous. It just meant he had to protect her even more carefully. And from the moment in the supermarket when he had realized he must pretend in order not to worry his mother, part of Will's mind was always alert to her anxieties. He loved her so much he would have died to protect her. As for Will's father, he had vanished long before Will was able to remember him. Will was passionately curious about his father, and he used to plague his mother with questions, most of which she couldn't answer.
Was he a rich man? Where did he go? Why did he go? Is he dead? Will he come back? What was he like?
The last question was the only one she could help him with. John Parry had been a handsome man, a brave and clever officer in the Royal Marines, who had left the army to become an explorer and lead expeditions to remote parts of the world. Will thrilled to hear about this. No father could be more exciting than an explorer. From then on, in all his games he had an invisible companion. He and his father were together, hacking through the jungle, shading their eyes to gaze out across stormy seas from the deck of their schooner, holding up a torch to decipher mysterious inscriptions in a bat-infested cave. They were the best of friends. They saved each other's life countless times. They laughed and talked together over campfires long into the night. But the older he got, the more Will began to wonder. Why were there no pictures of his father in this part of the world or that, riding with frost-bearded men on Arctic sledges or examining creeper-covered ruins in the jungle? Had nothing survived of the trophies and curiosities he must have brought home? Was nothing written about him in a book? His mother didn't know. But one thing she had said stuck in his mind.
One day you'll follow in your father's footsteps. You're going to be a great man too. You'll take up his mantle.
And though Will didn't know what that meant, he understood the sense of it, and felt uplifted with pride and purpose. All his games were going to come true. His father was alive, lost somewhere in the wild, and he was going to rescue him and take up his mantle. It was worth living a difficult life if you had a great aim like that. So he kept his mother's trouble secret. There were times when she was calmer and clearer than others, and he took care to learn from her then how to shop and cook and keep the house clean, so that he could do it when she was confused and frightened. And he learned how to conceal himself, too, how to remain unnoticed at school, how not to attract attention from the neighbours, even when his mother was in such a state of fear and madness that she could barely speak. What Will himself feared more than anything was that the authorities would find out about her and take her away and put him in a home among strangers. Any difficulty was better than that. Because there came times when the darkness cleared from her mind, and she was happy again, and she laughed at her fears and blessed him for looking after her so well. And she was so full of love and sweetness then that he could think of no better companion, and wanted nothing more than to live with her alone forever. But then the men came. They weren't police, and they weren't social services, and they weren't criminals, at least as far as Will could judge. They wouldn't tell him what they wanted in spite of his efforts to keep them away. They'd speak only to his mother, and her state was fragile just then. But he listened outside the door and heard them ask about his father and felt his breath come more quickly. The men wanted to know where John Parry had gone, and whether he'd sent anything back to her, and when she'd last heard from him, and whether he'd had contact with any foreign embassies. Will heard his mother getting more and more distressed, and finally he ran into the room and told them to go. He looked so fierce that neither of the men laughed, though he was so young. They could easily have knocked him down or held him off the floor with one hand, but he was fearless, and his anger was hot and deadly. So they left. Naturally, this episode strengthened Will's conviction. His father was in trouble somewhere, and only he could help. His games weren't childish anymore, and he didn't play so openly. It was coming true, and he had to be worthy of it. And not long afterwards, the men came back, insisting that Will's mother had something to tell them. They came when Will was at school, and one of them kept her talking downstairs while the other searched the bedrooms. She didn't realize what they were doing, but Will came home early and found them, and once again he blazed at them, and once again they left. They seemed to know that he wouldn't go to the police for fear of losing his mother to the authorities, and they got more and more persistent. Finally, they broke into the house when Will had gone to fetch his mother home from the park. It was getting worse for her now, and she believed that she had to touch every separate slat in every separate bench beside the pond. Will would help her to get it done quicker. When they got home that day, they saw the back of the men's car disappearing out of the close, and he got inside to find that they'd been through the house and searched most of the drawers and cupboards. He knew what they were after. The green leather case was his mother's most precious possession. He would never dream of looking through it, and he didn't even know where she kept it. But he knew it contained letters, and he knew she read them sometimes and cried, and it was then that she talked about his father. So Will supposed that this was what the men were after, and he knew he had to do something about it. He decided first to find somewhere safe for his mother to stay. He thought and thought, but he had no friends to ask, and the neighbours were already suspicious, and the only person he thought he could trust was Mrs. Cooper. Once his mother was safely there, he was going to find the green leather case and look at what was in it, and then he was going to go to Oxford, where he'd find the answer to some of his questions. But the men came too soon, and now he'd killed one of them. So the police would be after him too. Well, he was good at not being noticed. He'd have to not be noticed harder than he'd ever done in his life before, and keep it up as long as he could, till either he found his father or they found him. And if they found him first, he didn't care how many more of them he killed. Later that day, towards midnight in fact, Will was walking out of the city of Oxford, 40 miles away. He was tired to his very bones. He had hitchhiked and ridden on 2 buses and walked, and reached Oxford at 6 in the evening, too late to do what he needed to do. He'd eaten at a Burger King and gone to a cinema to hide, though what the film was he forgot even as he was watching it, and now he was walking along an endless road through the suburbs, heading north. No one had noticed him so far, but he was aware that he'd better find somewhere to sleep before long, because the later it got, the more noticeable he'd be. The trouble was that there was nowhere to hide in the gardens of the comfortable houses along this road, and there was still no sign of open country. He came to a large traffic circle where the road going north crossed the Oxford Ring Road going east and west. At this time of night there was very little traffic, and the road where he stood was quiet, with comfortable houses set back behind a wide expanse of grass on either side. Planted along the grass at the road's edge were two lines of hornbeam trees, odd-looking things with perfectly symmetrical close-leafed crowns, more like children's drawings than like real trees. The streetlights made the scene look artificial, like a stage set. Will was stupefied with exhaustion, and he might have gone on to the north, or he might have laid his head on the grass under one of those trees and slept. But as he stood trying to clear his head, he saw a cat. She was a tabby, like Moxie. She padded out of a garden on the Oxford side of the road where Will was standing. Will put down his tote bag and held out his hand, and the cat came up to rub her head against his knuckles, just as Moxie did. Of course, every cat behaved like that, but all the same Will felt such a longing for home that tears scalded his eyes. Eventually the cat turned away. This was night, and there was a territory to patrol. There were mice to hunt. She padded across the road and towards the bushes just beyond the hornbeam trees, and there she stopped. Will, still watching, saw the cat behave curiously. She reached out a paw to pat something in the air in front of her, something quite invisible to Will. Then she leapt backwards, back arched and fur on end, tail held out stiffly. Will knew cat behavior. He watched more alertly as the cat approached the spot again, just an empty patch of grass between the hornbeams and the bushes of a garden hedge, and patted the air once more. Again she leapt back, but less far and with less alarm this time. After another few seconds of sniffing, touching, and whisker-twitching, curiosity overcame wariness. The cat stepped forward and vanished. Will blinked. Then he stood still, close to the trunk of the nearest tree, as a truck came round the circle and swept its lights over him. When it had gone past, he crossed the road, keeping his eyes on the spot where the cat had been investigating. It wasn't easy, because there was nothing to fix on, but when he came to the place and cast about to look closely, he saw it. At least he saw it from some angles. It looked as if someone had cut a patch out of the air, about 2 yards from the edge of the road, a patch roughly square in shape and less than a yard across. If you were level with the patch so that it was edge-on, it was nearly invisible, and it was completely invisible from behind. You could see it only from the side nearest the road, and you couldn't see it easily even from there, because all you could see through it was exactly the same kind of thing that lay in front of it on this side, a patch of grass lit by a streetlight. But Will knew without the slightest doubt that that patch of grass on the other side was in a different world. He couldn't possibly have said why. He knew it at once, as strongly as he knew that fire burned and kindness was good. He was looking at something profoundly alien. And for that reason alone, it enticed him to stoop and look further. What he saw made his head swim and his heart thump harder, but he didn't hesitate. He pushed his tote bag through, and then scrambled through himself, through the hole in the fabric of this world, and into another. He found himself standing under a row of trees, but not hornbeam trees. These were tall palms, and they were growing, like the trees in Oxford, in a row along the grass. But this was the centre of a broad boulevard, and at the side of the boulevard was a line of cafes and small shops, all brightly lit, all open, and all utterly silent and empty beneath a sky thick with stars. The hot night was laden with the scent of flowers and with the salt smell of the sea. Will looked around carefully. Behind him the full moon shone down over a distant prospect of great green hills, and on the slopes at the foot of the hills there were houses with rich gardens, and an open parkland with groves of trees and the white gleam of a classical temple. Just beside him was that bare patch in the air, as hard to see from this side as from the other, but definitely there. He bent to look through and saw the road in Oxford, his own world. He turned away with a shudder. Whatever this new world was, it had to be better than what he'd just left. With a dawning light-headedness, the feeling that he was dreaming but awake at the same time, he stood up and looked around for the cat, his guide. She was nowhere in sight. No doubt she was already exploring those narrow streets and gardens beyond the cafes whose lights were so inviting. Will lifted up his tattered tote bag and walked slowly across the road towards them, moving very carefully in case it all disappeared. The air of the place had something Mediterranean or maybe Caribbean about it. Will had never been out of England, so he couldn't compare it with anywhere he knew, but it was the kind of place where people came out late at night to eat and drink, to dance and enjoy music. Except that there was no one here, and the silence was immense. On the first corner he reached there stood a cafe, with little green tables on the pavement and a zinc-topped bar and an espresso machine. On some of the tables glasses stood half empty. In one ashtray a cigarette had burned down to the butt. A plate of risotto stood next to a basket of stale rolls as hard as cardboard. He took a bottle of lemonade from the cooler behind the bar and then thought for a moment before dropping a pound coin in the till. As soon as he'd shut the till, he opened it again, realizing that the money in there might say what this place was called. The currency was called the corona, but he couldn't tell any more than that. He put the money back and opened the bottle on the opener fixed to the counter before leaving the cafe and wandering down the street going away from the boulevard. Little grocery shops and bakeries stood between jewelers and florists and bead-curtained doors opening into private houses, where wrought-iron balconies thick with flowers overhung the narrow pavement, and where the silence, being enclosed, was even more profound. The streets were leading downwards, and before very long they opened out onto a broad avenue where more palm trees reached high into the air, the underside of their leaves glowing in the streetlights. On the other side of the avenue was the sea. Will found himself facing a harbour enclosed from the left by a stone breakwater and from the right by a headland on which a large building with stone columns and wide steps and ornate balconies stood floodlit among flowering trees and bushes. In the harbour one or two rowboats lay still at anchor, and beyond the breakwater the starlight glittered on a calm sea. By now Will's exhaustion had been wiped out. He was wide awake and possessed by wonder. From time to time, on his way through the narrow streets, he'd put out a hand to touch a wall or a doorway or the flowers in a window box, and found them solid and convincing. Now he wanted to touch the whole landscape in front of him, because it was too wide to take in through his eyes alone. He stood still, breathing deeply, almost afraid. He discovered that he was still holding the bottle he'd taken from the cafe. He drank from it, and it tasted like what it was, ice-cold lemonade. And welcome, too, because the night air was hot. He wandered along to the right, past hotels with awnings over brightly lit entrances and bougainvillea flowering beside them, until he came to the gardens on the little headland. The building in the trees, with its ornate facade lit by floodlights, might have been an opera house. There were paths leading here and there among the lamp-hung oleander trees, but not a sound of life could be heard. No night birds singing, no insects, nothing but Will's own footsteps. The only sound he could hear came from the regular, quiet breaking of delicate waves from the beach beyond the palm trees at the edge of the garden. Will made his way there. The tide was halfway in, or halfway out, and a row of pedal boats was drawn up on the soft white sand above the high water line. Every few seconds a tiny wave folded itself over at the sea's edge before sliding back neatly under the next. 50 yards or so out on the calm water was a diving platform. Will sat on the side of one of the pedal boats and kicked off his shoes, his cheap sneakers that were coming apart and cramping his hot feet. He dropped his socks beside them and pushed his toes deep into the sand. A few seconds later he had thrown off the rest of his clothes and was walking into the sea. The water was deliciously between cool and warm. He splashed out to the diving platform and pulled himself up to sit on its weather-softened planking and look back at the city. To his right the harbour lay enclosed by its breakwater. Beyond it, a mile or so away, stood a red-and-white striped lighthouse. And beyond the lighthouse, distant cliffs rose dimly, and beyond them, those great wide rolling hills he'd seen from the place he'd first come through. Closer at hand were the light-bearing trees of the casino gardens, and the streets of the city, and the waterfront with its hotels and cafes and warm-lit shops, all silent, all empty, and all safe. No one could follow him here. The men who'd searched the house would never know. The police would never find him. He had a whole world to hide in. For the first time since he'd run out of his front door that morning, Will began to feel secure. He was thirsty again, and hungry too, because he'd last eaten in another world after all. He slipped into the water and swam back more slowly to the beach, where he put on his underpants and carried the rest of his clothes and the tote bag. He dropped the empty bottle into the first rubbish bin he found and walked barefoot along the pavement towards the harbour. When his skin had dried a little, he pulled on his jeans and looked for somewhere he'd be likely to find food. The hotels were too grand. He looked inside the first hotel, but it was so large that he felt uncomfortable, and he kept moving down the waterfront until he found a little cafe that looked like the right place. He couldn't have said why. It was very similar to a dozen others, with its first-floor balcony laden with flower pots and its tables and chairs on the pavement outside. But it welcomed him. There was a bar with photographs of boxers on the wall, and a signed poster of a broadly smiling accordion player. There was a kitchen, and a door beside it that opened onto a narrow flight of stairs, carpeted in a bright floral pattern. He climbed quietly up to the narrow landing and opened the first door he came to. It was the room at the front. The air was hot and stuffy, and Will opened the glass door onto the balcony to let in the night air. The room itself was small and furnished with things that were too big for it and shabby, but it was clean and comfortable. Hospitable people lived here. There was a little shelf of books, a magazine on the table, a couple of photographs in frames. Will left and looked in the other rooms, a little bathroom, a bedroom with a double bed. Something made his skin prickle before he opened the last door. His heart raced. He wasn't sure if he'd heard a sound from inside, but something told him that the room wasn't empty. He thought how odd it was that this day had begun with someone outside a darkened room and himself waiting inside, and now the positions were reversed. And as he stood wondering, the door burst open and something came hurtling at him like a wild beast. But his memory had warned him, and he wasn't standing quite close enough to be knocked over. He fought hard, knee, head, fist, and the strength of his arms against it, him, her. A girl about his own age, ferocious, snarling, with ragged, dirty clothes and thin, bare limbs. She realized what he was at the same moment, and snatched herself away from his bare chest to crouch in the corner of the dark landing like a cat at bay. And there was a cat beside her, to his astonishment, a large wild cat, as tall as his knee, fur on end, teeth bared, tail erect. She put her hand on the cat's back and licked her dry lips, watching his every movement. Will stood up slowly.
Who are you?
Lyra Silvertongue.
Do you live here?
No.
Then what is this place? This city?
I don't know.
Where do you come from?
From my world. It's joined on. Where's your demon?
His eyes widened. Then he saw something extraordinary happen to the cat. It leapt into her arms, and when it got there, it changed shape. Now it was a red-brown stoat with a cream throat and belly, and it glared at him as ferociously as the girl herself. But then another shift in things took place, because he realized that they, both girl and stoat, were profoundly afraid of him, as much as if he'd been a ghost.
I haven't got a demon. I don't know what you mean. Oh, is that your demon?
She stood up slowly. The stoat curled himself around her neck, and his dark eyes never left Will's face.
But you're alive. You ain't been...
My name's Will Parry. I don't know what you mean about demons. In my world, demon means... it means devil, something evil.
In your world? You mean this ain't your world?
No. I just found a way in. Like your world, I suppose. It must be joined on.
She relaxed a little, but she still watched him intently, and he stayed calm and quiet as if she were a strange cat he was making friends with.
Have you seen anyone else in this city?
No.
How long have you been here?
Dunno. A few days. I can't remember.
So why did you come here?
I'm looking for dust.
Looking for dust? What, gold dust? What sort of dust?
She narrowed her eyes and said nothing. He turned away to go downstairs.
I'm hungry. Is there any food in the kitchen?
I don't know,
she said, and followed, keeping her distance from him. In the kitchen, Will found the ingredients for a casserole of chicken and onions and peppers, but they hadn't been cooked, and in the heat they were smelling bad. He swept them all into the dustbin.
Haven't you eaten anything?
He said, and opened the fridge. Lyra came to look.
I didn't know this was here. Ooh, it's cold!
Her demon had changed again and become a huge, brightly coloured butterfly, which fluttered into the fridge briefly and out again at once to settle on her shoulder. The butterfly raised and lowered his wings slowly. Will felt he shouldn't stare, though his head was ringing with the strangeness of it.
Haven't you seen a fridge before?
He found a can of cola and handed it to her before taking out a tray of eggs. She pressed the can between her palms with pleasure.
Drink it, then.
She looked at it, frowning. She didn't know how to open it. He snapped the lid for her and the drink frothed out. She licked it suspiciously and then her eyes opened wide.
This is good.
Yeah. They have coke in this world, obviously. Look, I'll drink some to prove it isn't poison.
He opened another can. Once she saw him drink, she followed his example. She was obviously thirsty. She drank so quickly that the bubbles got up her nose and she snorted and belched loudly and scowled when he looked at her.
I'm going to make an omelette. Do you want some?
I don't know what omelette is.
Well, watch and you'll see. Or there's a can of baked beans if you'd like.
I don't know baked beans.
He showed her the can. She looked for the snap-open top like the one on the cola can.
No. You have to use a can opener. Don't they have can openers in your world?
In my world, servants do the cooking.
Look in the drawer over there.
She rummaged through the kitchen cutlery while he broke 6 eggs into a bowl and whisked them with a fork.
That's it. With the red handle. Bring it here.
He pierced the lid and showed her how to open the can.
Now get that little saucepan off the hook and tip them in.
She sniffed the beans, and again an expression of pleasure and suspicion entered her eyes. She tipped the can into the saucepan and licked a finger, watching as Will shook salt and pepper into the eggs and cut a knob of butter from a package in the fridge into a cast-iron pan. He went into the bar to find some matches, and when he came back she was dipping her dirty finger in the bowl of beaten eggs and licking it greedily. Her demon, a cat again, was dipping his paw in it too, but he backed away when Will came near.
"It's not cooked yet,"
Will said, taking it away.
"When did you last have a meal?"
"At my father's house on Svalbard. Days and days ago. I don't know. I found bread and stuff here and ate that."
He lit the gas, melted the butter, poured in the eggs and let them run all over the base of it. Her eyes followed everything greedily, watching him pull the eggs up into soft ridges in the centre as they cooked and tilt the pan to let raw egg flow into the space. She watched him, too, looking at his face and his working hands and his bare shoulders and his feet. When the omelette was cooked, he folded it over and cut it in half with the spatula.
"Find a couple of plates,"
he said, and Lyra obediently did so. She seemed quite willing to take orders if she saw the sense of them, so he told her to go and clear a table in front of the cafe. He brought out the food and some knives and forks from a drawer, and they sat down together, a little awkwardly. She ate hers in less than a minute, and then fidgeted, swinging back and forth on her chair and plucking at the plastic strips of the woven seat while he finished his. Her demon changed yet again, and became a goldfinch, pecking at invisible crumbs on the tabletop. Will ate slowly. He'd given her most of the beans, but even so he took much longer than she did. The harbour in front of them, the lights along the empty boulevard, the stars in the dark sky above, all hung in the huge silence as if nothing else existed at all. And all the time he was intensely aware of the girl. She was small and slight, but wiry, and she'd fought like a tiger. His fist had raised a bruise on her cheek, and she was ignoring it. Her expression was a mixture of the very young, when she first tasted the cola, and a kind of deep, sad wariness. Her eyes were pale blue, and her hair would be a darkish blonde once it was washed, because she was filthy, and she smelled as if she hadn't bathed for days.
"Laura? Lara?"
"Lyra."
"Lyra Silvertongue?"
"Yes."
"Where is your world? How did you get here?"
She shrugged.
"I walked. It was all foggy. I didn't know where I was going. At least, I knew I was going out of my world, but I couldn't see this one till the fog cleared. Then I found myself here."
"What did you say about dust?"
"Dust, yeah. I'm going to find out about it. But this world seems to be empty. There's no one here to ask. I've been here for, I don't know, 3 days, maybe four, and there's no one here."
"But why do you want to find out about dust?"
"Special dust. Not ordinary dust, obviously."
The demon changed again. He did so in the flick of an eye, and from a goldfinch he became a rat, a powerful pitch-black rat with red eyes. Will looked at him with wide, wary eyes, and the girl saw his glance.
"You have got a demon. Inside you."
He didn't know what to say.
"You have. You wouldn't be human else. You'd be half dead. We've seen a kid with his demon cut away. You went like that. Even if you don't know you've got a demon, you have. We were scared at first when we saw you. Like you was a night ghast or something. But then we saw you weren't like that at all."
"We?"
"Me and Pantalaimon. Us. But you, your demon ain't separate from you. It's you. A part of you. You're part of each other. Ain't there anyone in your world like us? Are they all like you, with their demons all hidden away?"
Will looked at the two of them, the skinny, pale-eyed girl with her black rat demon now sitting in her arms, and felt profoundly alone.
"I'm tired. I'm going to bed. Are you going to stay in this city?"
"Dunno. I've got to find out more about what I'm looking for. There must be some scholars in this world. There must be someone who knows about it."
"Maybe not in this world, but I came here out of a place called Oxford. There's plenty of scholars there, if that's what you want."
"Oxford? That's where I come from."
"Is there an Oxford in your world, then? You never came from my world."
"No, different worlds. But in my world, there's an Oxford too. We're both speaking English, ain't we? Stands to reason there's other things the same. How did you get through? Is there a bridge or what?"
"Just a kind of window in the air."
"Show me."
It was a command, not a request. He shook his head.
"Not now. I want to sleep. Anyway, it's the middle of the night."
"Then show me in the morning."
"All right, I'll show you. but I've got my own things to do. You'll have to find your scholars by yourself.
Easy. I know all about scholars.
He put the plates together and stood up.
I cooked, so you can wash the dishes.
She looked incredulous.
Wash the dishes? There's millions of clean ones lying about. Anyway, I'm not a servant. I'm not going to wash them.
So I won't show you the way through?
I'll find it by myself.
You won't. It's hidden. You'd never find it. Listen, I don't know how long we can stay in this place. We've got to eat, so we'll eat what's here. But we'll tidy up afterward and keep the place clean, because we ought to. You wash these dishes. We've got to treat this place right. Now I'm going to bed. I'll have the other room. I'll see you in the morning.
He went inside, cleaned his teeth with a finger and some toothpaste from his tattered bag, fell on the double bed, and was asleep in a moment. Lyra waited till she was sure he was asleep, and then took the dishes into the kitchen and ran them under the tap, rubbing hard with a cloth until they looked clean. She did the same with the knives and forks, but the procedure didn't work with the omelette pan, so she tried a bar of yellow soap on it and picked at it stubbornly until it looked as clean as she thought it was going to. Then she dried everything on another cloth and stacked it neatly on the drainboard. Because she was still thirsty and because she wanted to try opening a can, she snapped open another cola and took it upstairs. She listened outside Will's door and, hearing nothing, tiptoed into the other room and took out the alethiometer from under her pillow. She didn't need to be close to Will to ask about him, but she wanted to look anyway, and she turned his door handle as quietly as she could before going in. There was a light on the seafront outside shining straight up into the room, and in the glow reflected from the ceiling she looked down at the sleeping boy. He was frowning, and his face glistened with sweat. He was strong and stocky, not as formed as a grown man, of course, because he wasn't much older than she was, but he'd be powerful one day. How much easier if his demon had been visible. She wondered what its form might be and whether it was fixed yet. Whatever its form was, it would express a nature that was savage and courteous and unhappy. She tiptoed to the window. In the glow from the streetlight, she carefully set the hands of the alethiometer and relaxed her mind into the shape of a question. The needle began to sweep around the dial in a series of pauses and swings almost too fast to watch. She had asked,
"What is he, a friend or an enemy?"
The alethiometer answered, "He is a murderer." When she saw the answer, she relaxed at once. He could find food and show her how to reach Oxford, and those were powers that were useful, but he might still have been untrustworthy or cowardly. A murderer was a worthy companion. She felt as safe with him as she'd felt with Yorick Birneson, the armored bear. She swung the shutter across the open window so the morning sunlight wouldn't strike in on his face, and tiptoed out. Chapter 2 Among the Witches. The witch Serafina Pekela, who had rescued Lyra and the other children from the experimental station at Bolvanger and flown with her to the island of Svalbard, was deeply troubled. In the atmospheric disturbances that followed Lord Asriel's escape from his exile on Svalbard, she and her companions were blown far from the island and many miles out over the frozen sea. Some of them managed to stay with the damaged balloon of Lee Scoresby, the Texan aeronaut, but Serafina herself was tossed high into the banks of fog that soon came rolling in from the gap that Lord Asriel's experiment had torn in the sky. When she found herself able to control her flight once more, her first thought was of Lyra, for she knew nothing of the fight between the false Bear King and the true one, Yorick Birneson, nor of what had happened to Lyra after that. So she began to search for her, flying through the cloudy, gold-tinged air on her branch of cloud pine, accompanied by her demon, Kaisa the Snow Goose. They moved back towards Svalbard and south a little, soaring for several hours under a sky turbulent with strange lights and shadows. Serafina Pekela knew from the unsettling tingle of the light on her skin that it came from another world. After some time had passed, Kaisa said,
"Look, a witch's demon lost!"
Serafina Pekela looked through the fog banks and saw a tern, circling and crying in the chasms of misty light. They wheeled and flew towards him. Seeing them come near, the tern darted up in alarm, but Serafina Pekela signalled friendship, and he dropped down beside them. Serafina Pekela said,
"What clan are you from?"
"Thymir, my witch is captured. Our companions have been driven away. I am lost."
"Who has captured your witch?"
"The woman with the monkey demon. from Bolvanger. Help me. Help us. I am so afraid.
Was your clan allied with the child cutters?
Yes, until we found out what they were doing. After the fight at Bolvanger, they drove us off, but my witch was taken prisoner. They have her on a ship. What can I do? She is calling to me and I can't find her. Oh, help. Help me.
Quiet,
said Kaisa, the goose demon.
Listen, down below.
They glided lower, listening with keen ears, and Serafina Pekela soon made out the beat of a gas engine muffled by the fog.
They can't navigate a ship in fog like this. What are they doing?
It's a smaller engine than that,
said Serafina Pekela, and as she spoke there came a new sound from a different direction, a low, brutal, shuddering blast, like some immense sea creature calling from the depths. It roared for several seconds and then stopped abruptly.
The ship's foghorn.
They wheeled low over the water and cast about again for the sound of the engine. Suddenly they found it, for the fog seemed to have patches of different density, and the witch darted up out of sight just in time as a launch came chugging slowly through the swathes of damp air. The swell was slow and oily, as if the water was reluctant to rise. They swung around and above, the turn demon keeping close like a child to its mother, and watched the steersman adjust the course slightly as the foghorn boomed again. There was a light mounted on the bow, but all it lit up was the fog a few yards in front. Serafina Pekela said to the lost demon,
Did you say there are still some witches helping these people?
I think so. A few renegade witches from Volgorsk, unless they've fled too. What are you going to do? Will you look for my witch?
Yes, but stay with Kaisa for now.
Serafina Pekela flew down toward the launch, leaving the demons out of sight above, and alighted on the counter just behind the steersman. His seagull demon squawked, and the man turned to look.
You taking your time, ain't you? Get up ahead and guide us in on the port side.
She took off again at once. It had worked. They still had some witches helping them, and he thought she was one. Port was left, she remembered, and the port light was red. She cast about in the fog until she caught its hazy glow no more than 100 yards away. She darted back and hovered above the launch, calling directions to the steersman, who slowed the craft down to a crawling pace and brought it into the ship's gangway ladder that hung just above the waterline. The steersman called, and a sailor threw a line from above, and another hurried down the ladder to make it fast to the launch. Serafina Pekela flew up to the ship's rail and retreated to the shadows by the lifeboats. She could see no other witches, but they were probably patrolling the skies. Kaisa would know what to do. Below, a passenger was leaving the launch and climbing the ladder. The figure was fur-swathed, hooded, anonymous. But as it reached the deck, a golden monkey demon swung himself lightly up on the rail and glared around, his black eyes radiating malevolence. Serafina caught her breath. The figure was Mrs. Coulter. A dark-clothed man hurried out on deck to greet her, and looked around as if he were expecting someone else as well.
Lord Boreal?
He has gone on elsewhere. Have they started the torture?
Yes, Mrs. Coulter, but...
I ordered them to wait. Have they taken to disobeying me? Oh, perhaps there should be more discipline on this ship.
She pushed her hood back. Serafina Pekela saw her face clearly in the yellow light. Proud, passionate, and, to the witch, so young.
Where are the other witches?
All gone, ma'am. Fled to their homeland.
But a witch guided the launch in. Where has she gone?
Serafina shrank back. Obviously the sailor in the launch hadn't heard the latest state of things. The cleric looked around, bewildered, but Mrs. Coulter was too impatient, and after a cursory glance above and along the deck, she shook her head and hurried in with her demon through the open door that cast a yellow nimbus on the air. The man followed. Serafina Pekela looked around to check her position. She was concealed behind a ventilator on the narrow area of decking between the rail and the central superstructure of the ship, and on this level, facing forward below the bridge and the funnel, was a saloon from which windows, not portholes, looked out on three sides. That was where the people had gone in. Light spilled thickly from the windows onto the fog-pearled railing and dimly showed up the foremast and the canvas-covered hatch. Everything was wringing wet and beginning to freeze into stiffness. No one could see Serafina where she was, but if she wanted to see any more, she would have to leave her hiding place. That was too bad. With her pine branch, she could escape, and with her knife and her bow she could fight. She hid the branch behind the ventilator and slipped along the deck until she reached the first window. It was fogged with condensation and impossible to see through, and Serafina could hear no voices either. She withdrew to the shadows again. There was one thing she could do. She was reluctant because it was desperately risky, and it would leave her exhausted. But it seemed there was no choice. It was a kind of magic she could work to make herself unseen. True invisibility was impossible, of course, This was mental magic, a kind of fiercely held modesty that could make the spell worker not invisible but simply unnoticed. Holding it with the right degree of intensity, she could pass through a crowded room or walk beside a solitary traveller without being seen. So now she composed her mind and brought all her concentration to bear on the matter of altering the way she held herself so as to deflect attention completely. It took some minutes before she was confident. She tested it by stepping out of her hiding place and into the path of a sailor coming along the deck with a bag of tools. He stepped aside to avoid her without looking at her once. She was ready. She went to the door of the brightly lit saloon and opened it, finding the room empty. She left the outer door ajar so that she could flee through it if she needed to, and saw a door at the far end of the room that opened onto a flight of stairs leading down into the bowels of the ship. She descended, and found herself in a narrow corridor hung with white-painted pipework and illuminated with anbaric bulkhead lights, which led straight along the length of the hull, with doors opening off it on both sides. She walked quietly along, listening, until she heard voices. It sounded as if some kind of council was in session. She opened the door and walked in. A dozen or so people were seated around a large table. One or two of them looked up for a moment, gazed at her absently, and forgot her at once. She stood quietly near the door and watched. The meeting was being chaired by an elderly man in the robes of a cardinal, and the rest of them seemed to be clerics of one sort or another, apart from Mrs. Coulter, who was the only woman present. Mrs. Coulter had thrown her furs over the back of the chair, and her cheeks were flushed in the heat of the ship's interior. Serafina Pekela looked around carefully and saw someone else in the room as well, a thin-faced man with a frog demon, seated to one side at a table laden with leather-bound books and loose piles of yellowed paper. She thought at first that he was a clerk or a secretary, until she saw what he was doing. He was intently gazing at a golden instrument like a large watch or a compass, stopping every minute or so to note what he found. Then he would open one of the books, search laboriously through the index, and look up a reference before writing that down too and turning back to the instrument. Serafina looked back to the discussion at the table because she heard the word witch.
"She knows something about the child,"
said one of the clerics.
"She confessed that she knows something. All the witches know something about her."
"I am wondering what Mrs. Coulter knows,"
said the cardinal.
"Is there something she should have told us before, I wonder?"
"You will have to speak more plainly than that. You forget I am a woman, Your Eminence, and thus not so subtle as a prince of the church. What is this truth that I should have known about the child?"
The cardinal's expression was full of meaning, but he said nothing. There was a pause, and then another cleric said, almost apologetically,
"It seems that there is a prophecy. It concerns the child, you see, Mrs. Coulter. All the signs have been fulfilled. The circumstances of her birth, to begin with. The Egyptians know something about her, too. They speak of her in terms of witch oil and marsh fire. Uncanny, you see. Hence her success in leading the Egyptian men to Bolvanga. And then there's her astonishing feat of deposing the Bear King, Jofur Ragnarsson. This is no ordinary child. Fra Pavel can tell us more, perhaps."
He glanced at the thin-faced man reading the alethiometer, who blinked, rubbed his eyes, and looked at Mrs. Coulter.
"You may be aware that this is the only alethiometer left, apart from the one in the child's possession. All the others have been acquired and destroyed by order of the Magisterium. I learned from this instrument that the child was given hers by the master of Jordan College, and that she learned to read it by herself, and that she can use it without the books of readings. If it were possible to disbelieve the alethiometer, I would do so, because to use the instrument without the books is simply inconceivable to me. It takes decades of diligent study to reach any sort of understanding. She began to read it within a few weeks of acquiring it, and now she has an almost complete mastery. She is like no human scholar I can imagine."
"Where is she now, Fra Pavel?"
said the cardinal.
"In the other world. It is already late."
"The witch knows,"
said another man, whose muskrat demon gnawed unceasingly at a pencil.
"It's all in place but for the witch's testimony. I say we should torture her again."
"What is this prophecy?"
demanded Mrs. Coulter, who had been getting increasingly angry.
"How dare you keep it from me?"
Her power over them was visible. The golden monkey glared around the table, and none of them could look him in the face. Only the cardinal did not flinch. His demon, a macaw, lifted a foot and scratched her head.
"The witch has hinted at something extraordinary. I dare not believe what I think it means. If it's true, it places on us the most terrible responsibility men and women have ever faced. But I ask you again, Mrs. Coulter, what do you know of the child and her father?
Mrs. Coulter had lost her flush. Her face was chalk-white with fury.
How dare you interrogate me? And how dare you keep from me what you've learned from the witch? And finally, how dare you assume that I am keeping something from you? Do you think I'm on her side? Or perhaps you think I'm on her father's side? Perhaps you think I should be tortured like the witch? Well, we are all under your command, Your Eminence. You have only to snap your fingers and you could have me torn apart. But if you searched every scrap of flesh for an answer, you wouldn't find one. Because I know nothing of this prophecy, nothing whatever, and I demand that you tell me what you know. My child, my own child, conceived in sin and born in shame, but my child nonetheless, and you keep from me what I have every right to know.
Please,
said another of the clerics nervously.
Please, Mrs. Coulter, the witch hasn't spoken yet. We shall learn more from her. Cardinal Sturrock himself says that she's only hinted at it.
And suppose the witch doesn't reveal it? What then? We guess, do we? We shiver and quail and guess?
Fra Pavel said,
no, because that is the question I'm now preparing to put to the alethiometer. We shall find the answer, whether from the witch or from the books of readings.
And how long will that take?
He raised his eyebrows wearily and said,
a considerable time. It is an immensely complex question.
But the witch would tell us at once.
And she rose to her feet. As if in awe of her, most of the men did too. Only the cardinal and Fra Pavel remained seated. Serafina Pecola stood back, fiercely holding herself unseen. The golden monkey was gnashing his teeth, and all his shimmering fur was standing on end. Mrs. Coulter swung him up to her shoulder.
So let us go and ask her.
She turned and swept out into the corridor. The men hastened to follow her, jostling and shoving past Serafina Pecola, who had only time to stand quickly aside, her mind in a turmoil. The last to go was the cardinal. Serafina took a few seconds to compose herself because her agitation was beginning to make her visible. Then she followed the clerics down the corridor and into a smaller room, bare and white and hot, where they were all clustered around the dreadful figure in the centre, a witch bound tightly to a steel chair, with agony on her grey face and her legs twisted and broken. Mrs. Coulter stood over her. Serafina took up a position by the door, knowing that she could not stay unseen for long. This was too hard.
Tell us about the child, witch.
No!
You will suffer.
I have suffered enough.
Oh, there is more suffering to come. We have 1,000 years of experience in this church of ours. We can draw out your suffering endlessly. Tell us about the child.
Mrs. Coulter reached down to break one of the witch's fingers. It snapped easily. The witch cried out, and for a clear second, Serafina Pecola became visible to everyone, and one or two of the clerics looked at her, puzzled and fearful. But then she controlled herself again, and they turned back to the torture.
If you don't answer, I'll break another finger, and then another. What do you know about the child? Tell me!
All right! Please! Please! No more!
Answer, then.
There came another sickening crack, and this time a flood of sobbing broke from the witch. Serafina Pecola could hardly hold herself back. Then came these words in a shriek.
No! No! I tell you! I beg you! No more! The child who was to come. The witches knew who she was before you did. We found out her name.
We know her name. What name do you mean?
A true name. The name of her destiny.
What is this name? Tell me.
No. No.
And how? Found out how?
There was a test. If she was able to pick out one spray of cloud pine from many others, she would be the child who would come. And it happened at our consul's house at Trollesund. When the child came with the Egyptian men, the child... with the
Her voice gave out. Mrs. Coulter gave a little exclamation of impatience, and there came a loud slap and a groan.
But what was your prophecy about this child?
Mrs. Coulter went on, and her voice was all bronze now and ringing with passion.
And what is this name that will make her destiny clear?
Serafina Pecola moved closer, even among the tight throng of men around the witch, and none of them felt her presence at their very elbows. She must end this witch's suffering, and soon, but the strain of holding herself unseen was enormous. She trembled as she took the knife from her waist.
She is the one who came before, and you have hated and feared her ever since. Well, now she has come again, and you failed to find her. She was there on Svalbard. She was with Lord Asriel, and you lost her.
She escaped, and she will be...
But before she could finish, there came an interruption. Through the open doorway there flew a tern, mad with terror, and it beat its wings brokenly as it crashed to the floor and struggled up and darted to the breast of the tortured witch, pressing itself against her, nuzzling, chirruping, crying, and the witch called in anguish,
"Yameaka! Come to me! Come to me!"
No one but Serafina Pekala understood. Yambe-Aka was the goddess who came to a witch when she was about to die. And Serafina was ready. She became visible at once and stepped forward smiling happily because Yambe-Aka was merry and light-hearted, and her visits were gifts of joy. The witch saw her and turned up her tear-stained face, and Serafina bent to kiss it and slid her knife gently into the witch's heart. The tern demon looked up with dim eyes and vanished. And now Serafina Pekala would have to fight her way out. The men were still shocked, disbelieving, but Mrs. Coulter recovered her wits almost at once.
"Seize her! Don't let her go!"
she cried, but Serafina was already at the door with an arrow knocked in her bowstring. She swung up the bow and loosed the arrow in less than a second, and the cardinal fell, choking and kicking, to the floor. Out, along the corridor to the stairs, turn, knock, loose, and another man fell, and already a loud, jarring bell was filling the ship with its clangor. Up the stairs and out onto the deck, two sailors barred her way, and she said,
"Down there! The prisoner has got loose! Get help!"
That was enough to puzzle them, and they stood undecided, which gave her time to dodge past and seize her cloud pine from where she had hidden it behind the ventilator.
"Shoot her!"
came a cry in Mrs. Coulter's voice from behind, and at once three rifles fired, and the bullets struck metal and whined off into the fog as Serafina leapt on the branch and urged it up like one of her own arrows. A few seconds later she was in the air, in the thick of the fog, safe, and then a great goose shape glided out of the wraiths of grey to her side.
"Where to?"
"Away, Kaiser, away! I want to get the stench of these people out of my nose."
In truth, she didn't know where to go or what to do next. But there was one thing she knew for certain. There was an arrow in her quiver that would find its mark in Mrs. Coulter's throat. They turned south, away from that troubling otherworld gleam in the fog, and as they flew, a question began to form more clearly in Serafina's mind. What was Lord Asriel doing? Because all the events that had overturned the world had their origin in his mysterious activities. The problem was that the usual sources of her knowledge were natural ones. She could track any animal, catch any fish, find the rarest berries, and she could read the signs in the pine marten's entrails, or decipher the wisdom in the scales of a perch, or interpret the warnings in the crocus pollen. But these were children of nature, and they told her natural truths. For knowledge about Lord Asriel, she had to go elsewhere. In the port of Trollesund, the witch's consul Dr. Lancelius maintained his contact with the world of men and women, and Serafina Pekala sped there through the fog to see what he could tell her. Before she went to his house, she circled over the harbour, where wisps and tendrils of mist drifted ghost-like on the icy water, and watched as the pilot guided in a large vessel with an African registration. There were several other ships riding at anchor outside the harbour. She had never seen so many. As the short day faded, she flew down and landed in the back garden of the consul's house. She tapped on the window, and Dr. Lancelius himself opened the door, a finger to his lips.
"Serafina Pekala, greetings. Come in quickly and welcome. But you had better not stay long."
He offered her a chair at the fireside, having glanced through the curtains out of a window that fronted the street.
"You'll have some wine?"
She sipped the golden Tokai and told him of what she had seen and heard aboard the ship.
"Do you think they understood what she said about the child?"
"Not fully, I think. But they know she's important. As for that woman, I'm afraid of her, Dr. Lancelius. I shall kill her, I think, but still I'm afraid of her."
"Yes, so am I."
And Serafina listened as he told her of the rumours that had swept the town. Amid the fog of rumour, a few facts had begun to emerge clearly.
"They say that the Magisterium is assembling the greatest army ever known, and this is an advance party. And there are unpleasant rumours about some of the soldiers, Serafina Pekala. I've heard about Bolvanga and what they were doing there, cutting children's demons away. The most evil work I have ever heard of. Well, it seems there is a regiment of warriors who have been treated in the same way. Do you know the word zombie? They fear nothing because they are mindless. There are some in this town now. The authorities keep them hidden, but word gets out and the townspeople are terrified of them."
"What of the other witch clans? What news do you have of them?"
"Most have gone back to their homelands.
All the witches are waiting, Seraphina Pecola, with fear in their hearts for what will happen next.
And what do you hear of the church?
They're in complete confusion. You see, they don't know what Lord Asriel intends to do.
Nor do I. And I can't imagine what it might be. What do you think he's intending, Dr. Lansalius?
He gently rubbed the head of his serpent demon with his thumb.
He is a scholar,
he said after a moment.
But scholarship is not his ruling passion, nor is statesmanship. I met him once, and I thought he had an ardent and powerful nature, but not a despotic one. I don't think he wants to rule. I don't know, Seraphina Pecola. I suppose his servant might be able to tell you. He is a man called Thorold, and he was imprisoned with Lord Asriel in the house on Svalbard. Might be worth a visit there to see if he can tell you anything, but of course he might have gone into the other world with his master.
Thank you. That's a good idea. I'll do it. And I'll go at once.
She said farewell to the consul and flew up through the gathering dark to join Kaiser in the clouds. Seraphina's journey to the north was made harder by the confusion in the world around her. All the Arctic peoples had been thrown into panic, and so had the animals, not only by the fog and the magnetic variations, but by unseasonal crackings of ice and stirrings in the soil. It was as if the earth itself, the permafrost, was slowly awakening from a long dream of being frozen. In all this turmoil, where sudden shafts of uncanny brilliance lanced down through rents in towers of fog and then vanished as quickly, where herds of musk ox were seized by the urge to gallop south and then wheeled immediately to the west or the north again, where tight-knit skeins of geese disintegrated into a honking chaos as the magnetic fields they flew by wavered and snapped this way and that, Seraphina Pecola sat on her cloud pine and flew north, to the house on the headland in the wastes of Svalbard. There she found Lord Asriel's servant, Thorold, fighting off a group of cliff ghasts. She saw the movement before she came close enough to see what was happening. There was a swirl of lunging leathery wings and a malevolent yowk, yowk, yowk resounding in the snowy courtyard. A single figure swathed in furs fired a rifle into the midst of them, with a gaunt dog demon snarling and snapping beside him whenever one of the filthy things flew low enough. She didn't know the man, but a cliff ghast was an enemy always. She swung around above and loosed a dozen arrows into the melee. With shrieks and gibberings, the gang, too loosely organized to be called a troop, circled, saw their new opponent, and fled in confusion. A minute later, the skies were bare again, and their dismayed yow, yow, yowk echoed distantly off the mountains before dwindling into silence. Seraphina flew down to the courtyard and alighted on the trampled, blood-sprinkled snow. The man pushed back his hood, still holding his rifle warily because a witch was an enemy sometimes, and she saw an elderly man, long-jawed and grizzled and steady-eyed.
I am a friend of Lyra's. I hope we can talk. Look, I lay my bow down.
Where is the child?
In another world. I'm concerned for her safety, and I need to know what Lord Asriel is doing.
Step inside, then. Luke, I lay my rifle down.
The formalities exchanged, they went indoors. Kaisa glided through the skies above, keeping watch, while Thorold brewed some coffee, and Seraphina told him of her involvement with Lyra.
She was always a willful child,
he said when they were seated at the oaken table in the glow of a naphtha lamp.
I'd see her every year or so when his lordship visited his college. I was fond of her, mind. You couldn't help it. But what her place was in the wider scheme of things, I don't know.
What was Lord Asriel planning to do?
You don't think he told me, do you, Seraphina Pecola? I'm his manservant, that's all. I clean his clothes and cook his meals and keep his house tidy. I may have learned a thing or two in the years I've been with his lordship, but only by picking him up accidental. He wouldn't confide in me any more than in his shaving mug.
Then tell me the thing or two you've learned by accident.
Thorold was an elderly man, but he was healthy and vigorous, and he felt flattered by the attention of this young witch and her beauty, as any man would. He was shrewd, though, too, and he knew the attention was not really on him but on what he knew. And he was honest, so he did not draw out his telling for much longer than he needed.
I can't tell you precisely what he's doing, because all the philosophical details are beyond my grasp. But I can tell you what drives his lordship, though he doesn't know I know. I've seen this in 100 little signs. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the witch people have different gods from ours. Ain't that right?
Yes, that's true.
But you know about our god, the god of the church, the one they call the authority.
Yes, I do.
Well, Lord Asriel has never found himself at ease with the doctrines of the church, so to speak. I've seen a spasm of disgust cross his face when they talk of the sacraments and atonement and redemption and such like. It's death among our people, Seraphina Pecola, to challenge the church. But Lord Asriel's been nursing a rebellion in his heart for as long as I've served him. That's one thing I do know.
A rebellion against the church?
Partly, aye. There was a time when he thought of making it an issue of force, but he turned away from that.
Why? Was the church too strong?
No, that wouldn't stop my master. Now, this might sound strange to you, Seraphina Pecola, but I know the man better than any wife could know him. Better than a mother. He's been my master and my study for nigh on 40 years. I can't follow him to the height of his thought any more than I can fly, but I can see where he's a-heading, even if I can't go after him. No, it's my belief he turned away from a rebellion against the church, not because the church was too strong, but because it was too weak to be worth the fighting.
So, what is he doing?
I think he's a-waging a higher war than that. I think he's aiming a rebellion against the highest power of all. He's gone a-searching for the dwelling place of the Authority himself. And he's a-going to destroy him. That's what I think. It shakes my heart to voice it, ma'am. I hardly dare think of it, but I can't put together any other story that makes sense of what he's doing.